Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Out of sight, out of mind. At least that is the apparent logic of the authors of some startling new legislation that is being whispered about in the halls of Congress. If all public lands must pay their way, as is proposed for the national parks, with advertisements and fees at every turn in the trail, then why not expect the same from Congress? How about we sell seats in Congress to the highest bidder? Oh, sorry, that's apparently already being done. Well, we look at the future of our national parks when your voice of the earth returns, here on the Wildside News. So where is this all going? We find out as we continue this special edition of the Wildside News. Want to buy a national park?
Now we continue our talk with Bill Wade, who is with the Coalition for National Park Service Retirees. His home is in Tucson, Arizona. He's talking to me right now from Alaska. You Park Service guys are so lucky in the sense that you get to travel to all these extraordinary places. I kind of miss that a little bit. But anyways, I want to continue our discussion now, because suddenly, very recently, this whole issue of the future of the Park Service has really become a major issue in the press, in the Park Service itself, and in the public at large, and also definitely goes right into the realms of the politics. There have been a couple of things that have happened, beginning about somewhere this summer, and now suddenly within the last few weeks, that have really set off some alarm bells. First of all, there's an Undersecretary of the Interior, Paul Hoffman, who has written why don't you tell us what you know about this? Discuss what it is that suddenly went public.
Well, Paul Hoffman is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and he's one of these political appointees. His most significant job, I guess, prior to coming into this post in the Department of the Interior was he was the Director of the Chamber of Commerce in Cody, Wyoming, and had some run-ins, I guess, with the superintendents of Yellowstone National Park, and so apparently his view of national parks and the system is somewhat jaded maybe by those differences of opinion that he had. But anyway, he's now in a position in Washington to do some things that concern us, and the most notable thing that's come out in the last, couple months, was the release, it was actually a leak, of a draft revision of the National Park Service's management policies. Now, the Park Service has had management policies since 1918, and these are specified as the interpretation, the legal interpretation of the legislation that governs the way the national parks will be run. So these give a little bit more meat to the bone that consists of the legislation. Policies have been revised any number of times through the years since 1918, but they've always had a consistent determination that protection and preservation of the resources, as I said earlier, unimpaired for future generations, is the primary responsibility of the National Park Service. And there were some other factors that were absolutely consistent through the almost 90 years of the use of policies in the system. Mr. Hoffman's draft revision turned a lot of those concepts upside down, and very clearly, again, his foundation was to increase use, to increase access, to increase motorized recreation, to put the use and access more on what they consistently say should be an equal balance with preservation and protection, and that's not been the interpretation through the years. He's redefined, for instance, the term impairment. The policies up to this point have said that nothing will be allowed that will unreasonably impair resources. He's changed that to basically say that if something happens that is irreversible, then it shouldn't be allowed. And the problem with that definition is, how do you know that it's irreversible until it's already occurred, and then suddenly you find out that you can't do anything about it? with that kind of a definition and that sort of a policy, you could do things in parks, for instance, that might wipe out an entire population of species of animal. But as long as they exist somewhere else and in theory could be reintroduced, why it'd be okay to do that? So it's these kinds of things. Again, it's the thinking that is behind attempts to modify how the system is run that I think are most disturbing.
Also, in the Park Service, as everyone knows who's in the Park Service, those regulations are, in essence, law. You have to abide by those. And I guess what many people are witnessing again, which seems to be one of the strategies for change of the current administration, is to redraft such things as this management policy, as opposed to, for example, putting these things before Congress and having a debate about them, that at sort of almost by executive secondary fiat, wording is changed that can affect ultimately very significant outcomes in the futures of our parks, and without really there being the opportunity to effectively debate these publicly.
Certainly it's the purview of the administration to engage in the issue of policies. Congress is responsible for legislation. The executive branch interprets legislation through policy, and that's been that way for years. So it's not that they don't have the right to do this, but the precedent-setting part of this is not only the absolute, significant going from one extreme to the other almost of the proposed revisions, but the fact that it's been done largely in secret. The most recent policy change, for instance, that led to the current existing policies that were approved right at the end of the year 2000 took about 6 years to in the making, and these the chapters of the policies were actually drafted by subject matter experts within the National Park Service. It went through full internal review within the Park Service, and several times the public was encouraged to submit comments. This current process has been absolutely secret. There's only been probably three or four dozen employees in the Park Service, the top leadership, that's even seen the drafts that have been worked on since Mr. Hoffman released his version.
Now, how would they attain their legal status? How is that done?
Well, what we understand is happening right now is that the Park Service has been trying to develop a set of policies to counter Mr. Hoffman's draft and get it to the point where it's somehow acceptable to them, which, of course, suggests the possibility of compromise from where the policies now exist, and that worries us, of course. But when they reach that point, and we understand they are pretty close to reaching that point, and that perhaps as early as early next week or the end of this week, these will be put out through the Federal Register for formal public comment, and I suspect it will be a 60 or 90 day public comment period. And the public will be allowed, and by the way, for the first time, the actual employees of the National Park Service will be allowed to put their comments in about the proposed revision. Now, that sounds like a great democratic and political process, but the problem we've encountered in the past with these sorts of things, such as the snowmobile issue in Yellowstone, that the decision-making process for snowmobiles in Yellowstone have gone out to the public three different times. There have been over 250,000 accumulated comments from the public that have been submitted for those three comment processes, and we understand between 80% and 90% of the public has said they don't want snowmobiles in Yellowstone, and yet the administration and the political leaders of the Department of Interior basically ignore those public comments and are continuing to allow snowmobiles in Yellowstone. So the concern is, I guess, that they're moving forward with this, and if there are really damaging things that are included in these policy changes that could affect how parks are managed for years to come, and even if the public doesn't like that, the concern is that they'll go ahead and implement them anyway, because they just seem to not care what the public says.
How is that final decision made? Who has that authority to do so?
Well, for the policies, presumably the director of the National Park Service has that responsibility, but the way it's currently being played out, we know that there's a heavy hand being exerted on the director of the Park Service, who's a political appointee anyway, and who's certainly not totally against some of these proposed changes, as some, you know, as some directors in the past have been. But there's a heavy hand on the director by the political leadership of the Department of Interior, and so I think it's safe to say that it's the Department of Interior that will have the ultimate responsibility for implementing the policies through the director.
So there's no opportunity for legislative oversight, for example, unless there was some critical legal issue, I suppose. But
there is, and in fact, one of the other things that we understand is happening is that Senator Craig Thomas, who chairs the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, which has jurisdiction over the national park system, is going to schedule oversight hearings on these management policies probably sometime, a week or two after they're released for public comment. And so we would certainly encourage people to, number one, when the policies are released, to get a hold of those and look at them and then register their concerns about it, not only through the Federal Register process and whatever direction that gives to submit formal comments, but perhaps also to let their elected representatives know of what their concerns are, and perhaps in particular let Senator Thomas know as the chair of this committee on the Senate side.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's going to be a hearing on the House side also, probably from Congressman Pierce, who chairs the National Parks Subcommittee in the Congress. But I haven't heard a great deal of information about that one yet. So anyway, there will be some oversight, but these people haven't been particularly sensitive to what we think are the traditional values of national parks either. And so it seems like there's an opportunity here to do some, I think, some significant harm to the way national parks are likely to be managed in the near future.
This sets the groundwork for the next discussion. I'll summarize briefly. What is happening is that wording is changing that critically alter potentially the purpose and the function and the administration and preservation of our national park system that very few people may even know about. And there seems to be this process whereby it's done kind of behind the scenes, and then it kind of finds its way into law. And that brings us up to the next rather interesting document that's come out, and this is the Richard Pombo. I guess he's referring to this now as a draft, but this now, I think, is where we can begin to see what the direction that this is heading into, which is privatization of the parks. And this includes some really dramatic things. The thing that is capturing a lot of people's attention is the fact that included in this draft is a requirement that if we can't drill in Anwar, we're going to have to sell off 15 national parks. I mean, that's the one that's really capturing people's attention. And it goes beyond that. That's fairly dramatic. That's a really significant change in direction for the National Park Service.
Well, yeah, this is part of what some people are now referring to as the Pombo combo, because almost immediately on the heels of his attempt to and his successful attempt at getting through the House a revision that essentially dismantles the Endangered Species Act, he comes up with this scheme whereby revenue would be generated to offset the budget deficiencies, at least in part, by, as you say, selling off national park lands and increasing significantly advertising revenue, commercial revenue, and those sorts of things. And he has sort of characterized this as an idea that was just put forth to get people to think about it, which was the same thing, by the way, that Paul Hoffman said. Once these things became public, they started to try to distance themselves from them.
And I think that's the important point here, is the fact that now it's being referred to by the press and the spinners as just, well, an idea. Some guys got together and had a few beers or something and were thinking how they could make some money. But unfortunately, if this hadn't come out, perhaps this would end up being put into place as a policy.
Well, yeah, and as I said earlier, the disturbing thing really to most of us is the idea that there are even people in those kinds of positions that are thinking like this. I mean, you know, and if it you know, okay, maybe it's only two, but the idea that it's being thought about and it's being advanced as something that could take place, I think just opens up horrifying thoughts as to what the National Park System could do. And it's really a slap in the face, if you will, the idea of thinking about selling off national parks is an absolute arrogant slap in the face to previous generations who identified these areas as significant and identified them as areas that should be protected and revered for future generations. And now somebody like Pombo comes along and says, we don't care about those. It's more important that we get some immediate revenue, so let's just sell them off to developers. And, you know, to even be thinking like that is just absolutely scary.
Well, that goes back to the first point. It seems there's two types, those who get it and those that seem not to understand it at all.
That's correct. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go through a couple of the elements of this brainstorming document, which possibly was going to be slipped in somehow into the National Park Service vision and management strategy. One of them is that it would require commercial advertising. This is what is referred to. And by the way, these things have section numbers, so it gets beyond the point of just a simple brainstorming. It seems like this was really a precursor to some sort of legal form. The Section 6302 requires the sale of commercial advertising in all Park Service official maps and guides on the exterior and interior of buses, shuttles, vans, trams, and passenger ferries operated within the National Park System.
You're right about the sectioning. I mean, this thing was, I've seen the document, and it was written in the form of proposed legislation. So even though they're claiming that, you know, this was just a brainstorming idea, it's interesting that, you know, that the energy and effort and thinking that went through to put it together was such that it certainly could be rolled out as the proposed legislation. But yeah, your thoughts about the revenue from commercial advertising is sort of what I mentioned earlier, and was carried out or was also included you know, in the proposed management policies that Mr. Hoffman promoted. And in fact, there is currently before the public, again open for 60-day comment, a draft revision to what's called the director's orders on fundraising and donations. And, you know, one of the things that's proposed in this is that it would be okay for superintendents in parks to sell or to acknowledge or provide, you know, revenue raising by allowing somebody to buy a bench in front of a visitor center or to buy a brick that would be used to pave the area in front of a visitor center like you see in front of a lot of public buildings, and, you know, to put up some sort of acknowledgement. The concern there, of course, is that these kinds of schemes, both in terms of advertising and recognition of donations, you know, if they're carried out to any great extent in National Park Service areas, they simply begin to diminish those values and those purposes that I think people have come to be known as important in the National Park System. I mean, why would you want to go into Yosemite National Park and see advertising signs all over the sides of the tramway that goes through the valley, or enter the visitor center, you know, to a bunch of benches that are dedicated to somebody, or bricks, you know, with people's names all over them? I mean, it just seems to be totally out of place in National Park Service areas, and in our judgment, shouldn't be allowed. You know, that's what Pombo promoted. That's what, in one part, is suggested by the Hoffman revisions, and in fact now has gone one step further in terms of the proposed revisions of these guidelines, you know, that the director of the National Park Service is now proposing.
You know, I love Disneyland. I haven't been there it took me about 50 years to revisit it, but it's an extraordinary place. But it is Disneyland.
That's right.
We're talking now about national parks. So Section 6303 of the Pombo brainstorming document requires the Park Service to solicit and sell commercial sponsorship of park visitor centers, education centers, information centers, museums, trails, auditoriums, amphitheaters, and theaters throughout the national park system. And there's this little strange provision that maybe you can help me understand better. Collecting $10 million annually, apparently that's a requirement. And then if the Park Service fails to sell at least $10 million in sponsorships, all authority provided under the Park Service Concessions Management Improvement Act of 1998 would be in moratorium. Can you help me understand? First of all, your comments about the idea of having trails and auditoriums and amphitheaters with the logos and whatever it is. Let's start with that.
Yeah, I mean, it conjures up images in your mind about, you embark on the Wonderland Trail in Mount Rainier National Park through the Golden Arches and, with a sign above it that says this trail is sponsored by McDonald's or something like that. And not to pick on them, but the idea... Right. Certainly of corporate logos and advertising and, that form of recognition being scattered around parks, it seems like it's just absolutely, crazy. I think what that section that you're talking about is there's currently a provision of law that says that concession operations in parks, the franchise fees that are generated from those, are revenues that can be used in the parks for other purposes. And so I think what this would be is if that revenue fundraising part of this thing wasn't carried out to the extent that $10 million was raised, then basically the penalty would be that none of those franchise fees or none of the revenues that would be generated if it didn't reach the $10 million threshold would not be available to the park. So
I guess the thing that concerns me there is that as these penalties are enacted, it becomes more likely that the National Park Service may become dysfunctional for lack of funds, which is the one that really scares me at a deep level.
Well, in order to make the $10 million threshold, the tolerance of superintendents for maintaining some level of discretion and good sense in trying to approve these things might get very well stretched, and decisions begin to be made that even go beyond what the intent of these kinds of sections and policies are, and pretty soon, where does it all end? That's the concern I think we have.
And certainly not, as you say, we owe a lot to the partnerships by major corporations that have done so much to help support the parks. It's just that it seems as if there's a point reached at which maybe we're going a bit too far, and that we need to watch this change because it could permanently change the whole nature and spirit of this grand legacy of the national parks.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And, whether you talk about the idea of increasing motorized recreation in parks or you talk about the effects of commercial advertising and recognition and all that sort of thing, I mean, it comes down to the idea that at least at the outset, and I think most, certainly previous generations of Americans, and I think most Americans now do have the feeling that national parks are special. And it's one thing to say that I want to ride my snowmobile on public lands and to say that there's hundreds of thousands of acres of public lands that are available to ride snowmobiles on in the vicinity of Yellowstone National Park. But to accommodate somebody that says, I want to ride my snowmobile in Yellowstone National Park, begins to conjure up such things as, well, okay, where do we stop that kind of thinking? I mean, I've used the analogy that if I really enjoy skeet shooting and, target practice and that sort of thing, then should I have the right to carry out that kind of an activity in Independence Hall next to the Liberty Bell?
Well, it kind of makes me wonder if perhaps this could be taken to, maybe we should have bisons wearing sandwich boards with commercial advertising because it could generate revenue.
Sure, yeah,
be kind of cute.
It would. Your reference to Disney is, I agree with you. Disney is great, and there's a place for Disney, but we don't need to be Disneyfying the national parks, and we don't need to be allowing all things to all people in national parks, because the more you do that, the less special they become, and the more like everything else they are, and, you know, your grandchildren simply won't have the opportunity to partake in that specialness that, fortunately, up to this point in time anyway, has been preserved and protected.
Some of the details too, section, again, I want to be specific, because this indicates that this may have been more than just a brainstorming document, because it had some section 6307 requires the Park Service to remove Theodore Roosevelt Island, which is in D.C., from the National Park Service and make it available for immediate sale for purposes of commercial and residential development. And then moving right on, there's also section 6308 that requires the removal of 15 of the 17 sites from the National Park System that receive fewer than 10,000 visitors annually, and that those areas be made available for sale or for energy or commercial development by 2010. This begins to set the precedent that these lands should be made, public lands should be made available for increasing energy development and commercialization. That, to me, is where I think we begin to really chip away at the legacy in a most amazingly destructive way.
Well, yeah, it's interesting if you look at that list that was in that, in that whole thing that Pombo put together. It's pretty clear that there are two categories of land or of park areas that he offered up, so to speak. One are the areas in Alaska that, as he says, don't receive much visitation. They're very remote. They're very secluded. And I guess his feeling is that because not many people get to see those, they aren't worth anything, and so let's just drop them from the system and open them up for energy development and so forth. And then
that has a familiar ring to some other issues, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, for sure, and I think that's probably his purpose for, including those.
There were about seven, I think.
And then you look at the other ones that he listed, like the Eugene O'Neill House and the Frederick Law Olmsted Park in New England, and Theodore Roosevelt Island, of all things. I mean, poor old President Roosevelt must be rolling in his grave, That's the ultimate slap to a former Republican president to, sell off a memorial to that president just because it happens to be located in a wonderful area that, developers would love to grab up and put high-rise condos and offices on. And I make the point that anybody that even engages in this kind of thinking is just an absolute mystery to us, I guess.
Well, it's the thinking, and then to me, it's the strategy to put these things into these forms and trying to kind of have them happen without people noticing. But there is notice now, and that's certainly what we've been talking about here. We've laid the case, we've given the facts. What do you think is going to happen at this point? Any ideas?
Well, I think the first thing is that people who are interested in these issues need to really keep on top of them and learn when they are going to go out for public comment. This donations and fundraising policy that I mentioned earlier, this director's order, which is an extension of the policy, is open for public comment right now, and people who are concerned about what that might do specific to fundraising and donations in the parks ought to go to the National Park Service's website, which is www.nps.gov, and search out that it's called Director's Order Number 21, and comment on it. Submit the comments that they and their concerns about what that might do to parks. And When the management policies come out for public review, which again I'm told will be in the next week or so, sometime during that 60 or 90 day period, they ought to search out those policies and look at them and comment on the things that might be of concern to them. And above all, I think with things like Pombo's scheme and even Hoffman's ideas of changing the park system, express their concerns to their elected officials in Washington and to the Secretary of the Interior and to the Director of the National Park Service, because it's only, I think, a result of hearing from the American people that they still value the system, the national park system, that has existed for 90 years now, and that, you know, that they don't want it necessarily changed, is going to be the only thing that will keep these, you know, political operatives from pushing it down the line in the direction that the American public doesn't want it to go.
Hopefully we can change the direction. Our national parks are one of the grandest legacies. It is our legacy. I feel like I own this legacy. It belongs to me, and the opportunity for me to go there and be restored and to connect with things that are so critical and unfortunately diminishing day by day all around this planet, we need to change direction. Bill Wade is with the Coalition for National Park Service Retirees. Bill, if people want to contact your organization, how might they do so?
They can look at our website, which is www.npsretirees, that's one word, npsretirees.org, and it has most of the stuff that we've been talking about on it. It's a little hard to keep it up to date sometimes, but I think people can go there and look at the critical things that are happening. Among the other websites, for instance, National Parks Conservation Association, www.npca.org, is another place that people can find out about these things. And so I would hope that people who are concerned and interested about these issues that we've been talking about will do that.
Bill Wade, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice to the Wildside News, and let's keep in touch and stay informed. You're welcome here on the Wildside News anytime you have an opportunity to talk.
Great. Well, I appreciate you inviting me, and I'm glad that I was able to get up here to Denali National Park, where it's lightly snowing, by the way, in time to call in.
It's great. It's been a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As our nation debates the level of allegiance to certain doctrinal tenets of a Supreme Court nominee, as the sacred lands of our nation are nominated to go on the auction block, it begs the question, is nothing sacred? Not even our national parks. I quote from a speech by one of the key players in the struggle about who owns the land. And I quote, "Once we've lost that in this country, we've lost the backbone of our entire political system, the backbone of our entire economic system. It is critical to the survival of our country and to the kind of country we're going to leave to our kids and our grandkids. That's what the fight is all about. That's why it's so important. I think that each and every one of us has to look at this as a fight for the survival of our country." Thanks, Congressman Richard Pombo, for that rallying call to action. I couldn't have said it any better. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again, each Thursday or any time on the archives, when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wildside News.